Welcome to Ghostbusters, the radio show that talks about strange things in the neighborhood and weird stuff that don't look good. Talk about stuff that's messing with your head and crazy stuff that's happening in the bed. Why? Because many church folks are falling in the darkness, and the Bible calls us to walk as children of light. The Bible says, see then that you walk circumspectly, not as fools, but as wise, redeeming the time, because the days are evil. Welcome, 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 ladies and gentlemen, to Ghostbusters, the radio show that talks about strange things in the neighborhood and weird stuff that don't look good. Ladies and gentlemen, on yesterday, we began to listen to a documentary on why JFK, you know, President Kennedy, casket stayed closed. You know, he was shot right here in Dallas back in 1963. And there was a lot of different rumors about, you know, what was really happening. You know, I even heard as a little boy how, you know, the casket that they put him in when he first got shot wasn't the same casket that he ended up in when he got to Washington, D.C. and stuff. But we're learning a lot, ladies and gentlemen. It was the same casket, but it was a toe-up. It was a toe-up casket. These men, they was pulling on it and breaking the casket and stuff like that. And so, you know, I had never heard that side of the story. And so that's why, you know, we have Ghostbusters, where we can get down to the truth of the matters. But let me get on out of the way and let you hear the rest of why JFK casket stayed closed. Get close to your radio and listen.
And this is one of those cases, I think I agree. There is a certain type of funeral director who is equipped to create the absolute pageantry and flawless execution that is expected of a presidential funeral. I, for one, admit I would be completely unqualified. I'd be like Vernon O'Neill in there like, oh my god, why am I casketing a president who was assassinated like an hour before? Oh look, they stole my hearse. What is going on? But here is a crucial piece of information. Jackie Kennedy and Robert Kennedy did not want a funeral director involved at any point in Kennedy's death care and funeral. This was 1963, after all, and they knew their Mitford. A few months before Kennedy's assassination in 1963, Jessica Mitford's The American Way of Death was published to huge fanfare. It was a runaway New York Times bestseller, taking aim at the funeral industry, calling it a huge, macabre, and expensive practical joke on the American public.
Now these are lead-coated steels. Medium price range.
Mitford argued that the funeral industry in America sanitized death, while at the same time codifying its most gruesome practices, including the lavish casket, embalming, makeup, mourning memorabilia, and burial vault.
The Silent Night special. And very special it is too, if I may say so.
Her descriptions of the embalming process were so graphic that her first publisher broke their contract with her. When The American Way of Death was published, the average funeral came to the exorbitant cost of between $700 and $1,000. To put this in perspective, the median annual income was only $5,600. Mitford's righteous indignation at the high funeral costs and lavish funerary products tapped into the zeitgeist of the time. Americans felt deeply taken advantage of by the funeral industry, and we're ready for a scathing takedown.
This offers maximum protection for a unit in the middle price range.
As an alternative, Mitford argued for the simplest funeral possible with the simplest casket possible, followed by a cremation. There was no need for the dead person to be sprayed, sliced, pierced, pickled, trussed, trimmed, creamed, waxed, painted, rouged, and neatly dressed, transformed from a common corpse into a beautiful memory picture.
Not merely waterproof, nor moistureproof, Mr. Barlow, but dampnessproof.
The funeral industry, as you can imagine, could not have hated this woman more. Not only was she British, she was a former communist, the red sheep of her aristocratic English family. To this day, funeral directors are angry about Mitford, and they can really hold a grudge. You're just gonna need to trust me on that one. This is one part of what makes 1963 one of the most fascinating years in American death. Alongside the publication of The American Way of Death and the Kennedy assassination, there was the Pope stepping into the cremation debate and lifting the ban on cremation for Catholics. Catholics like the Kennedy family. When Mitford's book was published, only about 3% of Americans were cremated. 3%! Now, acceptance of bodily dispositions moves extremely slowly, but numbers began to rise with The American Way of Death's publication, growing to almost 60% of Americans now. I would argue a lot of those percentage points are as a result of the theoretical groundwork laid by Jessica Mitford and those who agreed with her. Which is not to say the legacy is not complicated. My colleague, Dr. Cammie Fletcher, argues convincingly that Mitford was so worried about the cost of funerals that she wouldn't allow her argument to be complicated by race, ethnicity, immigration, or even gender. And while I agree with Mitford's overall critique of the funeral industrial complex and the financial pressures on the family,
I can give you our eternal flame in either perpetual eternal or standard eternal.
I devoted a whole chapter in my first book to why telling families to cut out all ceremony and get the least expensive cremation you can find is not always the answer. It's the realistic interaction with death and rituals around the dead body that people were being cheated out of by the funeral industry, not just money. But most important for our purposes is that by the time of Kennedy's assassination, Mitford's book had infiltrated the Kennedy circle. Robert, his brother, had read it, as had Jack and Jackie's close friend, William Walton, his brother-in-law, Sergeant Shriver, and possibly, but not proven, even Jack and Jackie themselves. Unfortunately, unbeknownst to Jackie, the involvement of a funeral home had already been discussed in Washington earlier that day. Not only did they need a new casket, and boy howdy did they need a new casket, but despite Robert and Jackie's wishes that the military hospital, and only the hospital, handle the president's remains, it was not possible. While the hospital could do the embalming, quote, the military isn't equipped to prepare the remains. That is, they weren't restorative embalmers. They couldn't do the work to make Kennedy look like Kennedy again. He needed major reconstruction, and for that, he had to go to a specialized funeral home. Enter Joseph Gawler's Sons, a prestige funeral home that had been handling high-profile state deaths in Washington, D.C. since 1850. Gawler's had handled the remains of President Taft and President Franklin Roosevelt. Their viewing hours were even a tourist attraction in D.C. But first, they had to perform the autopsy. After accidentally leaving Kennedy in his casket behind with his makeshift pallbearers for 5 minutes outside Bethesda, the error was realized and Kennedy's casket was brought to the morgue. Only, once they were there, they realized that the stairway leading to the morgue doors was too narrow for the casket to fit. There was more manhandling and more banging up of the already broken casket. Could we just put him on a gurney or something? We can't do this anymore. It's simultaneously the best argument for having funeral directors to handle the body, and the best argument against funeral directors, since they're the reason this monstrosity of an overpriced hermetically sealed casket even existed in the first place.
All our units are waterproof.
When the casket finally made it into the morgue, the Handley Britannia casket was opened. And no, the plastic and rubber have not protected the interior of the casket from the carnage. Kennedy's remains were moved to an autopsy table by the Navy team that would perform the autopsy. Kennedy lay naked on the table. Aside from his head wound, he was remarkably unblemished. For hours, doctors performed an autopsy of the president, taking photos, extracting bullet fragments, examining the body for entry and exit wounds. A fragment of the president's skull had been found on Elm Street and had been sent to Bethesda. Said Lieutenant Richard Lipsey, who was present for the autopsy, there was no question in their minds that the bullets all came from the same direction. What if this suddenly became a second shooter on the Grassy Knoll video? It's not going to, but wouldn't that be a twist? And conspiracy people in the audience, and I know there are conspiracy people in the audience, I just want to talk about rising cremation rates through American history. Don't come for me. Was the CIA involved? Was Russia involved? Who knows? You know who was involved? Jessica Mitford. By midnight, the autopsy was finally finished. All during this time, Jackie, Robert, and Kennedy's people had been discussing the funeral, as well as who would handle the cosmetic reconstruction of the president, should there be a viewing, which was absolutely in question. Jackie remained in her stained suit, still exhibiting enormous compassion to those who had loved her husband. Though the autopsy was finished, the president still needed a new casket, so Ken O'Donnell and Larry O'Brien, another Kennedy advisor and Irish Mafia member, went to Gawler's to get a casket. There's some confusion as to what happened at Gawler's. In the spirit of Mitford, O'Brien requested the plainest one you have in the middle price range, and he was shown choices by Gawler's. Robert Kennedy thought he spoke to Gawler's about a moderately priced $1,400 casket, a point Gawler's does not recall. But a $2,000 casket was selected, and with it, the most expensive vault in the establishment. The total came to $3,160, which was not what Robert had asked for. Gawler's brought the casket to Bethesda, where their embalming and reconstruction team, supervised by Joe Gawler's chief assistant, Joe Hagen, went to work, attempting to fill and rebuild the president's missing skull and exposed brain with cotton and plaster. They worried the whole time about potential leakage from the skull, a very relatable funeral director concern. They worked until approximately 4 a.m. to set his face, return his pallor, and try to bring him back to the Jack Kennedy his wife and brother mourned. Journalist Jim Bishop reported that the morticians were, in a manner of speaking, magicians.
Oh, he's beautiful.
They repaired the president's shattered skull, layer by layer, quote, whispering incantations to each other, until Kennedy was whole again. They dressed him, put a rosary in his hands, and placed him into the new casket, made of gleaming African mahogany. As this was happening, tensions continued to rise around the question of the viewing. Jackie did not want an open casket, but Robert Kennedy and Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara believed that a president belonged to the people, and his casket must be open. "I want the coffin closed so badly. You can't have it open," Jackie insisted to McNamara in the kitchen at Bethesda. "It can't be done, Jackie. Everybody wants to see the head of state." "I don't care," she said. And she said of his embalmed body, "It's the most awful, morbid thing. They have to remember Jack alive." Said McNamara later, the tension in that kitchen was unimaginable. In the small hours of the morning, President Kennedy returned home to the White House, the path to the north portico lit by small flames. The light in the east room glowed. Military pallbearers carried the president's casket to the east room and placed it upon a catafalque. A priest said a prayer, as did Jackie. She then turned and went upstairs, leaving Robert to keep his promise to her that he'd settle the question of an open or closed casket. Robert asked the military death watch, a group of men who would stay vigilant at the dead president's side, to leave, and approached his brother's casket, the lid already opened for him. He looked down at his brother for the first time and realized there was no way his brother could be seen by the public this way. He exited the East Room and asked some other close friends to go look at the embalmed and reconstructed body, letting them know Jackie wants it covered. They would echo both him and Jackie, saying things like, "It's appalling. It's too waxen, too made up." The Kennedys' dear friend, William Walton, said, "You mustn't keep it open. It has no resemblance to the president. It's a wax dummy." "It," he said, "not him." Robert agreed and said, "Close it." And so it was. At Jackie's request, the casket was opened one final time on Sunday before President Kennedy went to the Capitol Rotunda to lie in state. Jackie wanted Robert and her to have some last moments of privacy with Jack. She asked Special Agent Hill to get her some scissors, and she cut a lock of Jack's hair. As of 12:46 p.m. on Sunday, November 24, 1963, President Kennedy's casket would never open again. Seeing him again, she was pleased with the decision to leave the casket closed. "It isn't Jack," she thought. "It isn't Jack." A quarter of a million people came to pay their final respects to President Kennedy. The casket remained shut. While Jackie and Robert did not fully get their wish that a funeral home would not be involved, they kept a tight grip on what this state funeral would be. No 5-foot-tall cross and silver candlesticks that Gawlers brought in, only flowers and simplicity. Well, simplicity for a state funeral of a sitting president, anyway. And this is really the question. How much did Kennedy belong to the people, and how much did he belong to Jackie and his family? Even I am torn on this. In many ways, I think Jackie did an elegant job of the balance. There is no doubt that Jackie indulged in public presidential pageantry for the benefit of a country in mourning. The same caisson that carried Lincoln also carried Kennedy to St. Matthew's Cathedral for the funeral mass, and then to Arlington National Cemetery, the cemetery Jackie chose as opposed to a Catholic cemetery, precisely because Jackie did believe he belonged to the nation. She chose to walk behind the caisson. Jackie remained in control for this funeral, from the music to asking her son John to salute his father's casket, which appears in this well-known photograph. At President Kennedy's grave, she was behind the placement of the eternal flame. But when it came to the body of JFK, Jackie didn't want that kind of funeral for her husband. She wanted something real and raw and connected. She had already sat for a full day covered in her husband's blood. She wasn't interested in turning that visceral grief and destruction into pageantry and the reconstructed waxen image of his face. Something that is often forgotten is that just 3 months before Kennedy was assassinated, Jackie Kennedy had given birth to her son, Patrick. Patrick lived just 2 days before dying of infant respiratory distress. Jackie would still have been in deep grief for her son when her husband was also taken from her. Maybe she no longer felt it was her job to do everything for the public, and her trauma required something different. What Jackie seemed to want was just access to her husband's body, as it truly was, chaotic though it was. Time for rituals, like giving him her ring and cutting locks of hair and dropping in letters from their children. She obviously was uncomfortable with funeral directors, but to be fair, she didn't want anyone around her husband other than their close family and friends. When Jackie herself died, more than 30 years later, in 1994, you saw these same tensions reflected. She made choices for privacy and intimacy. Her body was embalmed in her own bathroom and waked right in her living room. Yet she also understood her public duty and would be buried in Arlington Cemetery next to her husband in the same model of mahogany casket as John. Her son Patrick is buried there as well. And as you are probably wondering, you may not be wondering, what happened to O'Neill's original casket? 2 months after President Kennedy was buried, Vernon O'Neill requested the federal government pay him $3,995 for the casket. That's the equivalent of $37,000 in today's money. When the government balked, he dropped the price to $3,495. This public attempt to run collections on Jackie Kennedy caused a large drop-off in his business. O'Neill really would have preferred the original casket back instead, given that he had gotten offers of $100,000 for the casket from collectors. The Kennedy family insisted the government just pay for the casket and O'Neill services, a final settlement of $3,160, and the casket was taken into the government's possession. In late 1965, a bill was passed to preserve anything associated with Kennedy's assassination, But because the casket was discarded and considered surplus, except to those, quote, morbidly curious, it was decided it should be destroyed. On February 18th, 1966, the casket was flown 100 miles east of Washington to a spot in John F. Kennedy's beloved Atlantic Ocean. At 10 a.m., the casket, drilled with holes and weighted with sandbags, was pushed into the ocean from an aircraft, where it quickly sank. Apparently, Kennedy had spoken about a desire to be buried at sea. And as if evidence of how much the funeral industry had changed since the Kennedy assassination and Jessica Mitford, in 1999, after John F. Kennedy Jr.'s tragic death in a plane crash, his recovered remains were cremated, taken out to the Atlantic, some hundred or so miles from his father's first doomed casket, and committed to the sea. Thank you, as always, to our patrons, who give us the space for this level of research and the opportunity.
All right. You've heard the report, and now you know why JFK casket remain closed. All right, that's it for today. Thank you for joining us. Listen to us all day long, because we're in your corner right here on Ghostbusters.